Good evening, Larry. How are you on this Friday night?
I'm doing great, Andy, and it's a pleasure to be with you on Friday. It means I don't have to deal with you on my weekend.
Nope. Well, I mean, you could call Friday a weekend. I mean, we should both be out like partying and all that because it's a Friday night. But no, instead, we are dedicated to our listeners, and here we are recording this because I have prior obligations all next week. I have family coming.
That's fantastic. And where are they coming from?
They are coming from Pittsburgh. I'm looking forward to it.
Fantastic. Is this the first time they've been in the Peach State?
Oh, no. My wife and kid are from, well, not from here. I am separated due to the registry, frankly. And so they live up there. I live here because I can't get there. But they make an annual pilgrimage down here, I guess you could say.
All right. Well, make sure you give them I think they call it a peck. There's a bushel and a peck. That's a smaller. Make sure you give them a peck of peaches to take with them.
Oh, okay. Peck of peaches. Please consider making us part of your podcast diet. You can find us at Registry Matters on your smart speaker or podcast app of choice like Google Podcasts or Apple Podcasts. Also, if you like what you hear, please write a review. If you don't, just forget everything I just said. And this show is supported by our patrons, and you guys and gals are amazing. I can't thank you guys enough. We'd especially like to thank a new patron, Denise. Holy moly. Thank you so very much. That's just killer, Denise. Please send me a message with an address so I can mail you one of our exclusive Registry Matters blue balls. We did get a tip from Mr. Anonymous, who is a frequent communicator of mine, and he has a suggestion when dealing with your, let's just call them handlers. And if you have to give them any sort of email information or passwords to social media and stuff like that, what he suggests that you do is write it out, type it out, whatever, and print it and give it to them so that they can make a copy and sign it and give it back to you. So now you both have a record of the information that you say you've given, and they can't necessarily lose it and say that you didn't give it to them. That way, if there's any discrepancy in what you have versus what they have, then you have the evidence to support that you told your officer about your change. Do you think that's a good idea, Larry?
I like the idea. I don't know how far and how aggressive you can go with saying, sign this, please, but I like the idea of having documentation. I'm a big documenter, and I believe in that. Be careful that you don't push these people's buttons too far because they very well could retaliate, but I do like the idea of documentation, so I think that's a great tip.
When I first went and visited family in another state, and I went there, they would not sign my travel permit because I didn't need one on the receiving end. You're like, well, if you're not going to be here more than X days, bye. I'm not signing it. And I was like, I need to get this signed, and you won't sign it. So I see where you're going with that. And the guy was like very reluctant, but he eventually signed the paperwork. But it was very, very challenging. I can't make him do it.
That is true, and sometimes you can cause problems by pushing people to sign something. I've learned that in my decades on planet Earth.
Decades. You're going to be able to call it centuries here shortly.
Well, at least one century pretty shortly.
And Steve Yoder, who I guess we could call a friend of the movement, I saw a tweet from him, and the tweet is, "The federal government is now encouraging people to use the National Sex Offender Registry to shop for a home. Never mind the many government-funded studies about the fallacy of proximity in sex crimes." And if you get to the link, it's Office of Justice Programs. They have an article, and it says while you're searching for a house, consider things like schools or playgrounds, but also make sure that you check where the sex offenders live because maybe I guess you don't want to live in that neighborhood at that point.
That is an interesting use of the registry. I think it's linking people to the national registry, which is just a tool that searches within the state registries. It doesn't create registered people that are not on a state registry list.
Correct.
But it's an interesting thing to encourage people. What would be even funnier would be if the people who are trying to sell that home find themselves irritated about the suppression of the economic value of their home because that checking that registry. I think we've gotten evidence that it detracts from the value if there's a registrant within a certain vicinity of that home.
Yeah, I remember it being like a 10 or 15% depreciation in value of the home.
Well, I would like to see someone who feels that their home's been devalued. It'd be interesting to see what their remedy would be, if they would want to burn the registered person out, or if they would want to suppress the utilization of that tool, which ultimately depresses the value of their home. It's kind of like the employers in Texas who found it very inconvenient to take the harassment that they take for having people in the registry, and they linked up with Texas Voices and supported legislation that would take their address off of the website, which means that the employers are not harassed, because you can't just go find out who's employing people that are listed on the registry.
Right. And that would be a really powerful movement for an innocent bystander to be living near somebody on the registry and then their house is devalued.
That's my point. And yeah. I wonder if it's like I say, if I were still in the landlord business, if I was still in the property management, and I was subjected to not being able to choose my tenants because of some arbitrary rule that you can't have more than one person on the registry at any address, I would call that an interference with my business. And I know that most conservative people out there could not in good conscience support the government interfering with someone making a contract with a person of their choice. That would just go contrary to all American values, I understand.
It's interesting. You could also flip that over, and you could then go buy houses in those neighborhoods and know that you're going to get them at some sort of discount to become more profitable. So you could use it in a capitalistic sense.
You could, absolutely. And it would what benefit one party would be a detriment to another party. That acquiring party would appreciate that, and the selling party would not be as grateful.
Yeah. This article comes from the Collateral Consequences Resource Center. And this is an article about, I believe it's in Pennsylvania, where if you have a minor kind of offense, or even after a fairly short period of time, there will be automatic sealing of your records, which I don't think I was really able to figure out. Does automatic sealing mean that if someone searches that you have a felony, it says no, or does it just say no details provided?
I'm not clear on that either. It'd be nice for one of our Pennsylvania people to help us understand that. But my understanding, as I read the article, is that it would be suppressed from public view completely. They would be sealed. It would be as if they didn't have a public record. Now, the law enforcement apparatus would know.
Sure, sure.
And the judicial system would know if that person encountered. But it would be equivalent to forgiving you as far as the public's concerned, because if it's sealed, if these particular things that qualify, and everything doesn't, but if these things that qualify for sealing, that would make that person more employable, and it would put that event in their past, unlike people who have to deal with it for the remainder of their life. It's a great... The only reason I suggest we talk about this, because it shows progress. Progress is being made. And collateral consequences. The Resource Center has a lot of information that's very useful.
The final sentence that I captured was, the bill also authorizes automatic sealings of records that did not result in conviction. Can you expand on how that might play out? So you go to court and you are found not guilty. There are records of you being involved in the legal process, even though you were not guilty.
Well, that would be one example. That would be there's fair few people that are found not guilty, but you have cases that are procedure of dismissed. The prosecutors elect not to go forward. The police hand them. They do their arrest. Judge grants an arrest warrant, finding probable cause, and the prosecutor looks at the evidence and says, "I don't believe I've got enough here to secure a conviction." And there's cases that are null prosecuted. By the prosecutor, meaning we choose not to go forward. Well, that's still an arrest record.
Okay.
Well, there are those of us who believe that an arrest that didn't result in any prosecution and conviction probably shouldn't continue to harm you. But the business community argues just the opposite, and that's where you get into when you're trying to get this type of expungement or sealing legislation through. The business community says, "Well, we're responsible for the people we hire," and there's a number of games that could be played that could cause a person not to have a conviction, but we need this information to make decisions. And what they don't tell you is that they're ill-equipped to make the decisions. All they look is you got arrested for something and it seems serious by the title of the statute, the charge, and then they disqualify that person from consideration.
Okay.
This will help negate that.
The scenario that I'm picturing is you go to a nightclub and you're in there innocently, and you're hanging out with your friends, your girlfriend, boyfriend, whatever, and somehow there's some big drug bust that goes down, and literally you are innocent. You are just there with your friends, but somehow you end up being arrested in all that. Now there's an arrest record. You had nothing to do with it, but now your life is impacted because you got arrested as a collateral consequence of being in the wrong place at the wrong time.
That is correct, and that happens.
And therefore, someone, when you're going to then get a job, the business might do some sort of background check, and this shows up, and now you don't get the job because you were in the wrong place at the wrong time.
You don't get the job, and sometimes you don't get admitted to a university. I mean, we've got many cases where state-funded colleges and universities don't admit people because of something related to just what you described. That was they got a drug charge or something, and they don't get admitted. So it can be a life-altering event having an arrest record.
All right, so I'm just going to assert this. Take it however you want to, listeners. Don't leave your house.
Don't leave your house.
That's it. Well, done. Have all your food delivered, all that.
Well, these things, see, in years gone by, as technology has evolved, we didn't encounter this because an arrest record in San Jose, California wasn't going to hurt you in Houston, Texas.
Right.
I started to say Houston, Georgia, but nobody would know what Houston is. But an arrest record in San Jose, California 30 years ago wouldn't have harmed you unless you were going through a full FBI background check for a sensitive job. But it would be in the courthouse in San Jose. And when the employer in Houston checked you locally, if they went that far, they would find nothing. But that's not the way it is today.
Yeah, your whole background is just a few key clicks away.
And we haven't evolved. Our laws have not evolved and kept pace with the evolving technology. And it's going to require that the American people demand that we address something that we could not have visualized. It's going to be that living, that evolving standards of decency nonsense that comes out of liberals. But that's what's going to have to happen, is we're going to have to evolve our belief system that due to technology, we're going to have to suppress information that we wouldn't have needed to have suppressed 25 years ago before the advent of the internet and the wide accessibility and dissemination of information. It wasn't a big deal.
I was just going to go there, that it seems to me that when the country was founded and you set up the sovereign territories of the states, it was a significant ordeal for you to go from Flagstaff to, to El Paso. I mean, that would have been a monumental journey. And now here you and I are 2/3 of the way across the country communicating as if we're in the same room for zero expense. There's no dividing line there, really, in us being able to communicate. There's no dividing line in commerce or anything of that sort that the world, I could be in Japan and we could still be doing this. The world has become kind of like a single entity without having all of these different dividing lines. We have to change how we think about these things, that we're not just Georgia or New Mexico or California or Wisconsin. We are like humans on Earth.
That is correct. And it's going to require that some really, really aggressive leadership of people saying we can't tolerate this anymore, because we're suffering as a society from suppressing people's given abilities. If we allow people not to be able to overcome a mistake ever, we're suppressing the good of society. The entire productivity of the nation is being depressed by a misguided policy that we have that we're not dealing with. Let people put their past behind them at some point. And the some point is debatable, but let people put their past behind them and let's put this stuff out of public view.
Obviously, the registry lets them do that, right?
No, the registry, unfortunately, even when you get off the registry, it lives on the internet. Yeah. The fact that a person was registered, that we could spend an episode about that. There's people who think that they're done when they get their letter of release, and then they find all these private websites that have them still listed as... Well, it's terrible, because you never get past the registry if you've been on it.
All right, let's tiptoe around this one in a certain way. If you work your way into the United States in an unlawful fashion, not following the right immigration procedures, you didn't do a green card, visa, anything of that sort, and you end up somehow into the criminal justice system, do you still have your Fifth Amendment, your 14th Amendment, do you still have due process?
You absolutely do. If a person is in the United States and they're being accused of a crime, they have the same right in a custodial interrogation to remain silent regardless of their citizenship. They have the same right to have representation. They have the same right to be convicted by a jury of their peers. They have the same presumption of innocence. Whether or not they're legal, that is not relevant. Now, if you're talking about in a deportation process, it becomes a little murkier, and I'm not an expert on, by any means, on immigration law in terms of if they don't seek to prosecute them, they just simply want to deport them. But I do understand enough to know that if they are seeking any type of benefit that our immigration law provides, like asylum, refugee status, asylum for political persecution or for fear of their life, if they're seeking any type of there's a due process afforded under immigration law, and they have the right to that process as well.
The article that we're talking about is coming from the New York Times, and the title is Trump Calls for Depriving Immigrants Who Illegally Cross Borders of Due Process Rights. And the due process requirements of the 5th and 14th Amendment apply to all persons, including those in the U.S. unlawfully. And it is my understanding that regardless of how you got here, under what circumstances you arrived, if you end up somehow under the auspices of the law enforcement apparatus, as you call it, that you still had those privileges. You still had those rights afforded to you.
That is correct. And I've learned from Trump supporters that you're supposed to be smart enough to know when to take him seriously and when he's saying things he doesn't believe. But in my decades, I've always thought that a president, when they're espousing their position, they're saying what they truly believe. My thoughts would be, if he truly believes that we should deprive people due process of law, that is scary, frightening, dangerous. I don't know how to describe it. It would be tragic if that's what he really means.
Well, so let's go the other direction. He's been caught lying more than a handful of times, so why should we believe anything he says?
Well, that wasn't what I was meaning, but
I know.
His supporters apparently say you should know when to take him seriously and when he's just talking. I don't have the smarts to do that.
I don't either.
If a president says, I believe due process should be denied, I don't take that as rhetoric. I take that's what he means. And if he means that, since I'm not smart enough to figure out that whether he does or doesn't, I take it at face value. I think that's a dangerous position. Now, his supporters are welcome to come on and tell me if there's a certain way he holds his head, if there's a certain way he looks, if there's a way to tell when he's just talking to his base. I would like to know that, because I take him seriously at everything he says. When he says, these are my positions, I take him seriously. And if a president is saying due process should not be afforded to somebody, I think that is frightening.
And that, for me, that would be the reason why we would talk about this, not so much just a Trump bash, but that you are afforded, and you brought it up when we were talking about it before, if they're willing to do it to the people coming across illegally, how much of a stretch is it to then say, oh, well, hey, you're on the registry, you don't get afforded due process either, or, hey, you're wearing a red dress, and eventually you can move your way, not with a whole lot of imagination, to something from the 30s and 40s.
That is my fear. If Americans become comfortable with jettisoning and due process of law because it's inconvenient, due process is very inconvenient. And that could be due process in a criminal case or due process in a civil case. Due process in terminating an employee. You have a collective bargaining agreement, for example, and that evil union has extracted an agreement from the employer that we will not terminate someone except for going through these hoops. Those hoops can be cumbersome and time-consuming and sometimes expensive. Oh, due process is not always convenient.
You're talking about like the union rights worker stuff now, aren't you?
Well, not particularly, but I'm saying due process, regardless of whether it's in a criminal setting or civil setting, it can be very time-consuming and costly.
Right.
That's what tells what kind of people we are. That's what holds us above the rest of the world, because we're willing to do these things that are costly and inconvenient to give people a fair shake. And yes, it's inconvenient sometimes. You know that the person did whatever it is, you're a bad employee, and we need to fire you. But you agreed as a company that you would allow this pre-termination hearing, then you would allow full termination hearing, you would allow appeal, and blah, blah, blah. You didn't have to make that agreement, but you did. And that's what you have to do. And it's sometimes very inconvenient. Well, people who are in the United States illegally, they got into the country. If they're seeking to prosecute them for a crime or to expel them before they hear their whatever asylum claim or whatever relief they're seeking for a waiver, is what it's actually called, for whatever status they're seeking a waiver, there's a process, and it may be inconvenient, but that's our law. That's what separates us from the tyrants of the world.
I have then heard people say that, well, in other countries, if you steal something, they chop off your hand. And okay, that probably is a pretty good deterrent, because as soon as you walk around and see somebody without a hand, you can pretty much assume that that's what they did. So you could shame them for doing the stealing. But do we want to model ourselves after that kind of justice system?
There are some in America who would want to model ourselves after that. I'm not one of them.
To make a comparison to what you were just describing, though, if you go out and buy a luxury type product, there is a certain amount of the price that you're paying for. Yeah, it's just four wheels and it's got a motor and it gets you from A to B, just like a Yugo does. But you're paying for a certain level of service and status and reliability that would go along with that. And I'm using that as an analogy to say that our justice system should then push forward and try and do the higher integrity thing to set a higher standard so that we are that American exceptionalism for the rest of the world to look back upon and go, hey, those guys are doing it right.
That is correct. We like to think of ourselves as being exceptional. Many around the world think of us as being exceptional. Well, we degrade ourselves by doing things to take shortcuts, like what we did after 9/11 with the permanent detention of people in Guantanamo without any due process. Well, we launch drone attacks all over the world and pronounce ourselves jury, judge, executioner, without any due process. When we do these things, we diminish America. We diminish that beacon of hope that people look to and say, that's the country I want to go to. And people don't seem to understand that.
The next article is from Mother Jones. And I want to ask you a question. Do you think that people detained should have a right to vote if they're in jail?
Well, that's something I haven't thought about. How they're detained would potentially be an issue. If they're detained pre-conviction, absolutely,
yes.
I think they should.
That's what I was thinking. Is like if the popo comes and knocks on your door just before the November elections, and then you get detained for a couple of weeks, you've now just forfeited your right to vote, probably in most of the states.
That is correct. There's not a mechanism very often that allows a process for a correctional setting to allow people that are in detention to vote. But I would take it a step further. I would think that, I mean, we've got Vermont, I think, maybe a couple of northeastern states,
yes,
to allow people to continue voting. I don't see that that's a huge problem. I think that's probably a good thing.
And so this article is, Illinois wants to launch a huge get out the vote campaign in jail. And why would you go to the extreme and say, if you're convicted of a felony and you've just lost your right to vote forever, and we can scale it all the way back to where just maybe while you're on supervision, or maybe then it's just while you're incarcerated. Why would we make it so that those people can't vote? What would be the rationale behind making it so?
I've never completely understood why we don't want people to vote. I suppose it's some paranoia that they would vote in a way that would be detrimental to the society as a whole. But I tend to see that people who've been convicted tend to often vote. If those that do reassert their right to vote where it's available, they tend to be very conservative. So I don't see them voting to destroy. I don't see them. But I think the fear is that they're going to bring a lot of liberals in to the fold. And like if you took Cook County, Chicago area, and you set up a jail there and set up a polling place in Cook County detention, you'd have thousands of people potentially who would be voting. And this is just going to solidify that liberal rule. That would be part of the paranoia.
I mean, they're not going to vote for Art Bell or Alex Jones. I mean, and even if they did, okay, you get one or two votes. It's not going to change the outcome in that respect. I don't want to imply that one vote doesn't matter. But one vote for one person against 30 or 300 or 3,000 votes isn't going to matter.
Well, they seem to think so because there is opposition to this legislation.
Do you think it is because, hey, you've obviously have a screwed up way of thinking, therefore you probably shouldn't be voting? We don't want those kind of thoughts to infiltrate our election system?
I'm not sure, Andy. I'm not sure what the I can't fathom what I mean. There would be some complication in facilitating a polling location. There would be some gearing up. Jails are not usually set up for that, so it would require some accommodation. But I'd have to think that you could find a place within a detention like Cook County, within a facility like Cook County Detention, to have a voting place on Election Day.
You don't think it's completely cynical and it's just to take a certain class of people that end up to be the majority population in prison to keep them from voting, do you?
I've considered that. I don't have the evidence to support that, but it certainly disadvantages minorities a lot more. They are overly represented in the convicted felon population. Mm-hmm. And so it clearly takes the minority population down dramatically in terms of the voting participation.
Yeah. And before we get to the big news of the week, which I mean, maybe you could call it big news, but the second to last article, the penultimate article, is from the Marshall Project, another hurdle for former inmates, their teeth. Now, I know this from firsthand experience. The oral hygiene situation for people that are incarcerated, which then would probably translate to them getting out, is not so great. And fine, you should hire a person on their merits, but if you're going to put somebody at the cash register at McDonald's and they got a funky grill, it's not going to go over well. The customers are not going to take very kindly to somebody having all janked up teeth when they walk up to the counter.
Yeah, you got that right, and it can across the spectrum of employment where there's interaction with coworkers and with the public, and hygiene, dental hygiene, America, that's really a deficit across the board, but particularly for people who've been incarcerated, because I haven't served any of these prison stints, but I'm told that the basic dental health care is that if you got a bad enough toothache and an infection, they will set you up for an extraction and give you a Percocet.
Yep, that's it.
For pain, and as far as regular hygiene care, there I'm not aware of any taking place. So you have people that are incarcerated for long periods of time that come out with very degraded oral health, and it's one of the many barriers that you stack up against trying to go compete for a job. And I'd hate to say, but if I were interviewing, I would take that into consideration. I'd like to think I'm an objective person, but if I'm running a business and I'm trying to keep my customers happy, and I've got to have a person interacting with people who pay money to my business, I'm going to want the best face I can possibly put out there. Wouldn't you?
Absolutely. There's a picture of the feature person in the article. Very, very attractive redheaded lady. It says, I have all these barriers, barrier after barrier after barrier, a criminal history, my home address is a halfway house, I don't have any money to buy clothes so that I can present myself professionally, and then also my teeth are rotting. Not cool,
there
man.
There would be people who would say she did it herself. She was probably
She was a meth user.
Drug. Yeah, they would say that. But that's an example of what we talked about earlier, which will be played later, is our heartless, compassionless people. We do a lot of things to ourselves that we do. People who smoke, since we've had since 1964, stern warnings and evidence out there about the harmful about health. People overeating, people who do all sorts of things that degrade their health. This is just one of many things, mistakes that a person made. If we're going to hold that against them for the rest of their life, well, she did it to herself. She used crack. The hell with her. That says something about who we are. I would turn around and say, well, yes, she did use crack and she made a mistake, but I can get a whole lot better tax revenue out of her if she's working and making a whole bunch of money and paying into the systems that I want to draw from versus taking that heartless, cruel attitude that we have as too bad, so sad, she did it to herself. I want her to earn all the money she can possibly earn. Yeah. Don't you?
I'm very much with you on that argument. I really, really am. Well, you ready for the big topic of the week?
Well, the big topic. What would that be, Andy?
I think it kind of crossed the news wire just a little. I mean, maybe it was a blip on the radar.
So, yes, it was a blip.
Yeah, a blip.
It was definitely a blip.
Justice Anthony Kennedy decided that he wanted to retire, and he would have been considered, I guess you could kind of call him the swing vote. He was appointed by Reagan, I think. Is that right?
That would be correct. That would be correct.
And he definitely a conservative justice, but there were a lot of cases where he sided with the liberals. Now, part of the reason why this is so significant is there may have been a little delay tactics for the last 11 months of Obama's presidency, maybe.
There may have been. I don't think there's may would be the operative word.
How long does a president serve in office?
Well, they serve 4-year terms.
Is that like 4 years, so 365 times 4 plus probably one leap year in there?
Yes, that would be correct.
You start the day you start and you end the day you end?
Yes, that would be. You have full presidential powers, pardon powers, war-making powers, you name it. You have the obligation to make judicial appointments for the full presidency. That would be correct.
I heard Joe Biden say, the president shall nominate someone when that's their duty. They are obligated to do that thing. But that was held, so we ended up with Justice Gorsuch. And
let's just dissect it a little bit. We had the death of Scalia in February of 2016,
okay,
which was almost a full year before the January 20th end of his term, almost a full year. And the Senate, which is the confirmation body of the Congress, where the confirmation vote occurs, the Senate is under the leadership of the majority party, which controls that confirmation process. And Leader Mitch McConnell from Kentucky announced within hours that there would be no Obama nominee considered. End of discussion. And I've got decades of life experience, and I don't remember this ever happening where a Supreme Court justice nominee was ever proclaimed dead upon arrival, as it was. That was unprecedented.
Right.
And the reason given was that the American people should decide that. Well, the American people did decide this. They decided it when they elected President Obama.
3 years.
It was
prior.
His 8 years. He got a second term, and the American people gave him an 8-year opportunity to appoint justices and federal judges. And Leader McConnell deprived him of that. And I'll say it to the detriment of some of our listeners who want, they stole that seat.
Yeah. I saw a very snarky interview with him, and he said, it is my privilege to not hold that hearing. I saw him. He was just like smiling with that little turtle head of his. I saw him smiling, saying it was my privilege to not have that hearing.
Well, but they didn't only steal that seat. They held up federal judge appointments for the entire time Obama was in office, because he was appointing, in McConnell's opinion, two judges that were too liberal. So therefore, they inherited over 100 vacancies, which they had blocked appointees, and they blocked so many that the previous Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid had changed the rules to stop. They were filibustering everything, not only judicial appointees, but cabinet appointees, agency heads, everything that they were blocking. They were doing total obstruction. And that is that was their doctrine for the Obama presidency. But amazingly now, it doesn't seem like they believe that the president during an election year, because which is what McConnell said, that being an election year, that the American people should be able to weigh in. Now, I wonder why we're much closer to the election. Now, this is the end of June, and his retirement is effective July 31st, which puts us far closer to an election. I wonder why the American people, under the McConnell doctrine, are not allowed to weigh in by who they elect to the U.S. Senate. And it could be possible that they could elect different senators in November, because one-third of the Senate is up for election. I wonder where the McConnell doctrine is now. Of course, I know it's hypocrisy, which typically goes with politics.
Well, but they are expected, they are forecasted to even receive to win more seats in the Senate. So why wouldn't they just wait till after the election? It could just solidify, because right now they're running really split. It's because McCain is basically out, and then you have a handful of kind of moderate Republicans, and so it could be a very dicey confirmation hearing that they might not be able to get somebody through. It might seem in their interest to wait.
It you never know with politics.
Certainly.
The math is not in favor of the Democrats. When people look at the makeup now, it's 51-49, 51 Republicans, 49 Democrats. And they say, well, gee, all the Democrats have to do is pick up two. But what makes it more complicated is one third of the Senate is elected each 2 years.
Right.
Of that one third that's up this year, two thirds of them are Democrats. So in order for the Democrats to pick up a majority, they have to successfully defend about 24 seats. Mm-hmm. And several of those seats are in conservative-leaning red states.
Yeah, they're like 20% Trump areas.
Yeah, you got Senator Joe Manchin, who's in great jeopardy. You've got Claire McCaskill in Missouri. I could go on and on with people who are representing red states. The Democrats probably won't successfully defend all those seats, but you would have to successfully defend all the seats. Then you would have to go into a much smaller sliver of Republican seats that are up for election this year, and you'd have to do a net pickup of two if you successfully defend those seats. But if you have Republican pickoffs in two or three seats, then all of a sudden you've got to pick up five seats. If Manchin loses and McCaskill loses, you go from having to pick up two seats to four seats, and you're only competing with the Republicans are up for election. You're only competing in a small number of states where there's even a possibility. So mathematically, it could be that the majority in the Senate increases
right
in December. Well, in November.
Well, that's why I'm saying they should possibly just wait, and it would be even that much more in their favor.
But you can't. You know, you've got the majority now.
But they might not have it now. I mean, they might, but there might be some flip-flops.
They've got the majority now.
Sure. I know they do have it, but I'm saying, like, I mean, it's kind of split. If you get one or two Republicans to flip over and say,
well, you only have to get one. If mm-hmm. McCain is not able to show up to vote, he yep. can't vote by proxy, but mm-hmm. if McCain can't show up to vote in person, and who knows which way he would vote, but if McCain doesn't show up to vote, then you're down to 50.
Right.
And if one senator holds out and says, yep. I want something in exchange for my vote, which that's exactly what I would do if I were a senator. I would extract whatever I could for my vote.
Of course.
If you've got one senator that says, I'm not sure about this nominee, Mr. President, then you get into a bidding war. You could, and you've got women senators on the Republican side. You've got Susan Collins. You've got Lisa Murkowski from Alaska, Susan Collins from Maine. You could have either one of those who are very concerned about Roe v. Wade, and they may be very reluctant, depending on who's put forward to vote to support that nominee. It could be that he can't get a nominee through of his liking, and mm-hmm. he may have to wait if the votes are not there.
What do you think that this ultimately has to do with any sort of cases that would be running up the flag to work its way to the Supreme Court that would be in our favor, to our benefit somehow?
I hate to be totally negative on conservative appointees, because occasionally you get a good ruling from a conservative, but it's only very occasionally. If you follow the Supreme Court and you look at things to do with criminal law, you'll see the makeup is usually the four liberals that were appointed by Democratic presidents are more often going to be on our side. And as I've said in private conversation, you don't agree with your spouse on everything. I could point to stuff with Elena Kagan and Sonia Sotomayor that I would not agree with. But I'm going to be agreeing with them a whole lot more than I'm going to be agreeing with Clarence Thomas or Samuel Alito or John Roberts or even Neil Gorsuch. Gorsuch was on the right side of one case on his first year on the court. He was on the, as far as I'm concerned, everything else I looked at it, I disagree with him. He was on the right side of the void for vagueness about if you're going to deport someone, you have to make it clear what it is that they violated that's a deportable offense, what's a serious felony. We talked about that on a podcast. I applaud him for being right one time, but I would rather have someone who's going to be with us more often, and typically the conservatives are more deferential to law enforcement powers. And searches and seizures are not as big of a problem. Prison rights are not as big a problem for conservatives. A prisoner really has no rights except for the privileges that they're given. I mean, you're typically going to find that our cause is going to be best served by having more progressive judges. Trump is not likely to appoint a progressive judge unless he's forced to do that by the Senate. He's given a list. And as far as I can tell, on about the 20-some-odd people on the list, there's not a lot of progressives on that list. I don't think anyone has been identified as a progressive. So we're not likely to get a progressive appointee willingly from Trump. But before I say further, in 1987, when we got this justice, the situation was slightly different. You had you had Democratic control of the Senate, I believe. I'm not absolutely sure, but we ended up with a compromise candidate with Anthony Kennedy. There were two nominees put forward by President Reagan that were rejected. One was rejected outright on a vote. He went down. That would be former Solicitor General Robert Bork, who served in the Nixon administration, and then a nominee named Douglas Ginsburg, who admitted that he'd used marijuana. I don't think that Ginsburg, that would disqualify a candidate today, but that was shocking that someone nominated for the Supreme Court could admit that they'd used marijuana. And Ginsburg withdrew, and we ended up with Kennedy. But that was only after there was an attempt to put a very hard liner with Robert Bork, and that failed because of opposition in the Senate.
I was listening to something driving home from dinner tonight, and now that I'm losing my train of thought on what it was.
You got old timers, Andy.
I know it. I'm not too far behind you.
It was 88 that the vacancy was earlier, but it was 88 that Kennedy was appointed.
Oh, I know what it was. Okay, here's what I was going to ask you. They brought up that candidates in no time that anybody can remember, they have put out their list of nominations or nominees that they would put in for a Supreme Court. Since we already had the vacancy going into it, you obviously had this window of opportunity. And somehow, for some reason, the right side is very motivated by Supreme Court justices. The left side, just for whatever reason, doesn't really care. They are not motivated by this. And since Trump put out that list with Gorsuch at the top of it, then they knew that by voting for Trump that they would put that guy in there and they would start to move the court further and further to the right, possibly setting up a situation where you could go after Roe or other being more corporate-friendly, etc. What would it take, do you think, to get the left to get motivated about, I mean, this is, for our cause, those judges are really, really, really critical for what we're trying to do.
I don't know, Andy, what it would take to get our, because my experience tells me our audience tends to be a leading conservative, and they believe vehemently with all their soul that the conservative justice is going to save us. And we do our best. We have to work with what the courts, we don't get to pick the courts. We work with what we have. And you have to, as Paul Dubling, attorney in Raleigh, says, you have to craft your arguments to try to appeal to conservatives. But there's just more tolerance for law enforcement, typically, and intrusions by law enforcement. And the registry is but a mere intrusion, generally speaking, for conservative judges. If you look at the dissent in the Smith versus Doe, there were three that dissented. It was 6-3, and the dissents were large. But I think there was one even conservative in the dissent of that. It may have been Scalia, but the liberals are more likely to be hesitant to allow the government to do what they're doing. And I don't know what it's going to take to motivate people, because the Supreme Court is really off most people's radar. I mean, you're not thinking about the Supreme Court. You're thinking about other things when you vote in elections. When's the last time you went out and said, I got to vote for this person because of the Supreme Court? I've never, until 2016, I never thought about that much. And I've been voting for 40 years.
Yeah, I never actually cared. But this is the most significant thing that the president does, is nominate these justices. And these are the guys that we are about to bring all of these cases to. And if they are not in our camp, then going back to a conversation we had about the executive branch and what power, like, hey, what does it matter, the politics of the executive branch? I mean, they should just go follow the laws that are dictated down to them. But this being the big deal, then, I mean, who's the judge in Colorado that was favorable to that decision? We talked about that the other day.
Senior Judge Richard Mache.
He's got an odd last name. So Judge Mache, he is somebody that would be more likely in our camp about how these situations come down the road. But that guy got there by somebody in the executive branch nominating that person in place. This really, really, really frickin' matters.
And that person that nominated him was President Richard Nixon.
But that's a Republican, isn't it?
Yes, it was. Now, Nixon, the art of screening judicial appointments has evolved in the decades since Richard Nixon, and it largely was a senatorial function, and it still is to some degree. When there was a federal judgeship open in New Mexico, Donald Trump doesn't go looking for somebody. He asks New Mexico senators to make recommendations. And if you get your senator's recommendation, and until the McConnell regime came in, normally if a senator from a state opposed a judge being confirmed, they would not be confirmed. That tradition is breaking down. But Richard Nixon appointed Judge Mage, and I think it has a lot to do with his senior status. He's in a category of judges where he just doesn't have to think a whole lot about statistics and appeals and being flipped by the Tenth Circuit. He's 80 plus years old, 84, 85 years old. He just doesn't really care if they flip him. He would prefer they didn't, but he's not going to lose a lot of sleep over getting flipped by the Tenth Circuit. He did what he thought was right. He saw something he thought was constitutionally defective, and he struck it.
Well, and so that kind of shut my argument down if he was appointed by Nixon, who was a Republican. But like you said, the times have changed along with things like the filibuster. Tell us what a filibuster is.
Well, a filibuster is a process, procedural use to prevent a vote in the Senate. And the rules they're not constitutional. They're Senate rules. And the filibuster was to prevent a runaway of public opinion. If you get 50 plus one, or even 50, if you control the executive branch, because the vice president can break the tie, then you don't even have to have majority of the elected senators from the state. If you get 50 votes under just simple majority, well, that was a protection, a check and balance to make sure that we had consensus for important issues. And it used to be 2/3. Right now, for the things that can still be filibustered, it's 60 votes, which means you need a supermajority of 60 to do what's called a cloture. And a cloture is to simply close the debate. So a debate can go on and on until there's a motion for cloture. Well, on Supreme Court nominations, when they get out of Judiciary Committee, which is where they're going to be referred to, the Senate Judiciary Committee, the Republicans have the majority, so they will be able to, in all likelihood, move the nomination to the floor of the Senate. And then under the pre-McConnell changes, there would have needed to be 60 votes for cloture. Well, you would never get to 60 because Republicans only had 51 votes. So therefore, they would never have been able to move on the nomination without changing the rules. So the rules proved to be inconvenient, and they changed the rules. And now it just requires a simple majority. So the Democrats were powerless to stop it by a parliamentary maneuver. The only way they could stop this nomination would be by public opinion. If the public were to rise up and say, Mr. President, Mr. McConnell, we agree with you that during an election cycle, you should not make these appointments because the American people, we're getting ready to weigh in this fall. Therefore, you should hold off. If the phone started ringing and McConnell started getting these phone calls, he might reconsider trying to rush something through. But I don't see that happening because the people that are likely to support McConnell, they're going to be happy to him rush something through because they're not going to take a chance that they're going to get a progressive, because as far as they're concerned, a progressive would be the end of all life as we know it. That's what's wrong with this country, is we've got too many damn liberals involved in things.
Clearly.
Clearly.
This depresses
Nobody me. Uses that. No one uses that term liberal anymore. They're now progressives. They don't right. liberal.
Well, but one person called me a libtard one day.
A what?
A libtard. Someone said, "Hey, you're one of them damn libtards." I was like, "What?" Yeah, libtard.
Libtard. I don't think I've ever heard that one.
No, they kind of.
I think that would be
too.
A combination between a liberal and a retard. I think that's what they were telling me.
That is exactly what it is. And I don't consider myself to be a liberal. That's the funny thing.
And certainly you're not a retard, and I wouldn't even use that except for just responding to that, but that is a very pejorative, derogatory term.
It was definitely that. We don't communicate anymore, incidentally.
Yeah, I would think not, that person. Are they one of our Patreon supporters?
Oh, no. This is a 3 or 4 year old relationship at this point now, somebody that lived nearby me some time ago.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher, or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
And joining us now is Nick Dubin. And we'd like to thank Nick Dubin for joining us to talk about autism and the registry. I met Nick on Twitter, and we've had some fun conversations back and forth. And just to give you some background, Nicholas Dubin was diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder in 2004. He holds a bachelor's degree in communications from Oakland University, a master's degree in learning disabilities from the University of Detroit Mercy, and a specialist degree in psychology and a doctor of psychology from the Michigan School of Professional Psychology. He has authored many books on autism spectrum disorder, including Asperger syndrome and anxiety. He is dedicated to helping those individuals on the autism spectrum receive due process and justice within the criminal justice system. Welcome, Nick. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Andy. It's my pleasure to be with you.
Well, thank you for joining. Let's begin with you said that you were diagnosed in 2004. How does that even come up?
In adults, it usually comes up when somebody has suffered a crisis of some kind. In my case, I had failed a student teaching assignment, and it was just one of many things that had not gone right for me in life. And usually for adults, it comes to a point where they ask themselves, okay, what's going on here? I need to look into the literature to see if I have some kind of condition that I've never heard of. And so that's what happened with me. I got into my graduate program in psychology, and they required that I take a class in abnormal psychology to get into the program. And in doing so, I came across autism spectrum disorder, which was then called Asperger syndrome, and read the diagnosis right out of the textbook. And I'm like, this fits me to a T. And so then I just got a diagnosis from a neuropsychologist. It took about 3 days, gave me a lot of tests, interviewed my parents, got a big developmental history on my life. And it turned out that I was on the spectrum. So it was a relief in knowing that I was on the spectrum. And it also explained a lot of things that without the diagnosis, I wouldn't have been able to understand.
All right. Well, I'm just going to throw this out there. We've been talking for about a half hour now, and I wouldn't be able to tell that there's anything. I'll just use the word wrong. I wouldn't detect anything odd about you from the conversation that we've had so far. You seem to be, I don't want to use the word normal in a pejorative way, because then the opposite of normal is abnormal, but you sound normal.
I get that a lot, and I think that people with autism tend to be good at masking their diagnosis. One thing you have to keep in mind is this is a very structured interview. So and I'm going to disclose to the audience that you sent me a lot of the questions in advance. We had talked a lot in advance, and I think for a lot of people with autism, as long as there's some sort of script that they're following, and the script is that I'm answering your questions, I kind of know what's coming at me, I'm able to follow that script. However, if you put me in an uncomfortable or more unfamiliar situation, I wouldn't do as well at all, and you would see all the screws come loose. But again, because this is very tightly controlled, it's not going to come across to the average person as it would under other circumstances. And that's why you see a lot of people on the spectrum are on the speaker circuit. They're writing books. They are doing things that you wouldn't necessarily think they could do being on the spectrum, but yet they're able to do it because it matches their unique set of skills.
Do you think if you put anybody on the spectrum in a sort of confined area of expertise, instead of having them multitask across this discipline or that discipline, just across a whole multitude of things, that they would break down then? But if you keep things narrow focused, that not that they could do anything, but an individual could do a focused group thing that they would excel at.
It depends. I mean, it depends if it matched their interests.
Right.
There'd definitely be a better chance of that. I think that multitasking is a weakness in general for people on the spectrum. I'm not going to say that nobody can multitask. I don't want to make a generalization, but it does tend to be a weakness. So when you can get something that matches the person's interests and there's a passion for it, and also some repetition that they know what's coming, there's an amount of sameness that they get each time they do the task. and they don't have to worry that it's going to be different each time, then yes, I think definitely there can be success.
I'm kind of thinking that part of the reason why we're doing this podcast is sort of like drip feed Larry teaching me how to go be an advocate to the to the legislatures. But so it's just like a drip feed of practicing so that I don't end up being surprised, so that I kind of know what the script is. I will know what the responses is to the questions or the situations that would come up. I don't know that that would be that different than many people. You can't just throw someone into these completely random new situations and expect them to excel at it.
I think we're talking a matter of degree, though. When we're talking about somebody on the autism spectrum, we're talking about very specific routines and rituals that if they deviate from those, it would be different than how you would react to it. For example, there are some people with autism, myself included, we have to do the same thing each time, every day, the same way. And there can be no deviation from it. And when there is, there can be all-out emotional, what they call meltdowns, that can be used in a pejorative way, but it's really true. And this is why, you know, a lot of people with autism struggle going through the TSA. Some of them have meltdowns when their planes are late. Now, that probably wouldn't cause you to go into an emotional breakdown, but that does happen to people on the spectrum. So when I'm talking about unfamiliar situations, I'm talking about things that can deviate from what was planned, not necessarily something new that you're trying for the first time, if that makes any sense.
No, it totally does. It totally does. Can you give me a practical definition of what autism means? And then to expand that out, what does it mean when someone says they're on the spectrum?
Well, basically, it's a communication disorder. And you need basically persistent deficits in social communication and social interaction. It will show up. It may not show up all the time because, again, people can mask the disorder in many ways, but you're going to see it. You're going to have people who have difficulties in interpreting nonverbal communication and reading eye contact and body language and so forth. And then another major component is what we just talked about, the restricted repetitive interests. You can see this from a young age. So, for example, I had motor issues. I flapped my hands up and down, kind of like, just uncontrollable flapping of my hands, jumping up and down, echolalia, which basically means repeating back what you've just heard and doing it over and over again, not being able to express yourself. For me, I didn't speak until I was 4 years old. And when I did gain language, all I could do was repeat back what other people would say to me. So the way you can really weed out a true autism diagnosis from that is to go back to early childhood. What was that child doing in early childhood? And those are where the clues are. And that's what separates a quirky person, a quirky adult, I should say, from someone with autism. Because if they have autism, those signs show up in childhood because you're born with autism. So you're gonna see it when somebody's about 2, 3, 4 years old. It's not going to just show up in adulthood.
It's just fascinating. I can't help but see myself in what you're describing, but I haven't ever been tested or have been diagnosed with. Then what does it mean? What is the opposite of high functioning? And can you describe what those couple definitions would be?
Well, when we talk about functioning, that can be kind of a politically loaded term in the autism community because, we don't like to create hierarchies. But functioning is basically, from a clinical point of view, speech, being able to have employment. And we can get into some of this as far as how autism negatively or how the registry negatively impacts having autism, but having employment, the degree to which one is hyper or hyposensitive to different sensory inputs. So there are some people who are so sensitive they need to wear sunglasses all the time, or they're wearing earplugs all the time, or they need sensory input they need to be massaged, deep tissue massage, or they won't feel regulated or balanced. So it depends on how well one can function in the world. And usually that means being able to live independently, having a job, relationships. And those are the things that we measure people for, good or bad. That's usually how we do it.
then let's just dive right in. How does having being on the spectrum, how does that impact someone when they end up encountering law enforcement and the registry ultimately?
Well, let me talk about law enforcement first. I think that there can be a lot of misunderstandings when an individual on the spectrum encounters law enforcement. You can have a person who, first of all, doesn't even know why they're being approached by law enforcement because they're on the spectrum, and they may be exhibiting a behavior that's perfectly normal for them. That, you know, they could be stimming their hands, and when I say stimming, I mean repeatedly flapping their hands or putting their hands over their head, whatever. The police officer can think that the person on the spectrum is either intoxicated or is using drugs. And so that's the premise that the police officer uses when they approach the person with autism. Not necessarily that he has autism, but that he may be intoxicated. And so that's where they approach the situation from. And so you can see that a person on the spectrum is going to react a certain way. If they're being approached aggressively and they don't know why, then you're just setting up a situation for conflict. And one of the things I talk about on Twitter all the time is the need for training. Training won't solve everything, but at least sensitizing police officers to some of the behaviors they're likely to encounter so that they can differentiate between somebody who's truly intoxicated or is under the influence of certain drugs, and someone on the spectrum, and that they can approach that person in a more gentle, kind of humane way where they're not necessarily making assumptions. The registry is a whole other issue in and of itself, but we're talking about the initial first encounter with law enforcement, and it can be catastrophic at times. People have lost their lives because of that misunderstanding.
I heard a podcast recently. There was a gentleman, I'm pretty sure this happened in Florida. He was very, very, very severely autistic. I think I read that he had an IQ of around 40. He's outside playing with a truck. He's in his 20s, but he has fallen outside of the social safety net system. You know, he's not a minor. And then whatever further treatment he was able to procure, then he ends up in a group home, and somebody calls the cops because they see some sort of interaction that doesn't fit their model of how two people should be interacting. And the cops end up on the scene, and they're trying to interact with the person with autism and not compliant. Not that he's not being compliant, but he's not recognizing that they're even there, really. But ultimately they end up shooting and hitting the person that is taking care of the person with autism. He ends up being handcuffed and kept in a car for 2 hours. I mean, it's just a brutal, unfair situation to put somebody in with that diminished of a capacity.
I would totally agree. And it happens far too frequently. And we need to train officers to approach individuals with autism that they want to be compliant, they just need different sets of instructions. They can't be approached in an aggressive or confrontational way because that's just going to evoke a response that won't match what the officer is looking for. Individuals with autism are rule followers. They like to be compliant. Right. So officers need to keep that in mind. And usually if they're not being compliant, it's because they're not understanding what's going on. They don't understand.
Well, and then I can't remember what this article was, but someone on the spectrum ended up texting with a female, and I guess she ended up being underage, but he didn't understand that she was being flirtatious and making moves, blah, blah, blah. And next thing you know, the police are knocking on the door, and his bedroom was closest to the door. So he opens up the door, the cops come in, and next thing you know, they're arresting him because he admitted to having some sort of sexting with an underage girl that he didn't even realize he was having.
Exactly. And that's the kind of thing that can happen all the time. And it does happen all the time. I can get into that if we have time later in this interview. But somebody with autism is going to be very isolated. Typically, they're not going to have tons of friends on the outside, so they turn to their computer. They may get into a conversation where on the computer, somebody finds them appealing because they can at least interact on the computer, and they really don't understand that because it's over the computer and not real life, the line blurs. And of course, when the police show up, they're going to be honest about everything, a lot of them, because it's very hard for them to be deceptive or tell lies. So usually a full confession will ensue when you have an individual on the spectrum, and that's, of course, used against that person. And so that's a scenario that I'm very familiar with. My father, who is very familiar with this also, who's spoken to many parents of children and adults who are on the spectrum, we've heard this about 50 or 60 times from families who have gone through that kind of scenario that you just described.
Larry, I'm sure you have things that you can chime in at this point.
I'm just learning a stuff here that I have a deceased sister who was on the spectrum, much lower functioning, but had she interacted with law enforcement, this would have been a disaster, a total disaster.
The thing that I wanted to bring up specifically to you, Larry, if you confess, it's really hard to overcome that, right?
It would be very difficult if the person does that freely and knowingly, and
here's the thing, Larry, that I think your audience may be interested in, and that is when an individual on the spectrum, and this may be true for all people, but it's specifically true for people on the spectrum, when they hear "we will help you out if you tell the truth" or whatever, you will get a lighter sentence. And again, they're allowed to lie and they're allowed to make promises. If an individual with autism, assuming they haven't had any interaction with the law, they're going to believe that. And they're going to think, okay, if I just tell the truth, then this was a misunderstanding and everyone will understand that I wasn't trying to do anything wrong. And this will solve itself. That's the kind of thinking that goes on. And so the confession is made. And as I said, this could happen to a neurotypical too, but I've seen it where with people on the spectrum, they make these confessions believing that the officers involved were basically telling them the truth when they said, we're going to get you off. It happened to Brendan Dassey. Brendan Dassey, who is not going to have his case heard before the Supreme Court. That's exactly what they were telling him. And he has some sort of intellectual developmental disability. I think that's pretty well established. And they lied to him. And he basically said whatever they wanted him to say. And that's pretty common. It happens all the time with people on the spectrum.
We actually have that article to cover tonight. And the final sentence of the article says, and he just said, hey, can I go back to class now? After he gives them the confession, he's just like, oh, hey, I'm done. Is this over? Can I just go back now? It's like he doesn't even recognize the impact of the statements that he's just made. And he's supposed to have an IQ of somewhere around 70, and yet he's in prison for life.
Exactly. It's very clear that by asking if he could go back to class, in my mind, he probably wasn't involved in the murder because I think he would take the situation more seriously. But it also could be a function of his autism, thinking, not understanding the severity of being questioned by two detectives, especially if it was in his school and he wasn't taken to the police station. And my understanding is it was in his school. So, yeah, that is an unfortunate situation. It's tragic for Brendan. And unfortunately, people on the spectrum do suffer these kinds of consequences because of the communication breakdowns that take place between law enforcement and those on the spectrum.
Larry, did you have stuff to finish up?
Yeah, I was starting my thoughts in response to your question. When a person makes, we start with a presumption when you're dealing with law enforcement that everyone is competent. That's an issue that a person has to raise later. So when a person gives a confession and makes a statement, There is a presumption that they were competent and they were able to understand what they were doing, and it's up to the individual in most cases to raise the issue later that they weren't of sound mind, they weren't fully competent in recognition and understanding what they were doing. So to answer your question, it's very difficult to set aside those statements that were made. In the case of the we're going to talk about later, that one's very unique because he was a minor, and there's supposed to be extraordinary care given in a case of a minor, that there's a parent or someone there to make sure that the minor knows what they're doing. But setting aside a statement that, and not just people on the autism spectrum, people in general who have never experienced any encounters with the law, they believe these are good guys. They've been told to revere these people growing up. You respect the badge. You respect the honor. They're on our side. They're for us. And people tend to believe the cops when they tell them that they're there to help them. We just want to get this straightened out and get the truth. So it's not just unique to the autism spectrum, but I was making the point that it makes it very difficult to set that aside later because you're presumed competent.
It was funny the way that you worded that, Nick, is I don't know that anybody feels any different when the police try and tell you, oh, we're on your side. We believe you. We're going to help you get through this. I think most people believe that that's true. Oh, this is just a misunderstanding. And once we get this cleared up, I'll just go home and I'll have dinner with my family later. But that is definitely not how it goes.
If you've not encountered the cops right. in your life, you're law-abiding citizens that have their first encounter. They are shocked beyond belief about what goes on. They never would have imagined that the good guys do this stuff.
And I'm totally not diminishing the impact of having being on the spectrum then further complicates things. But I'm just pushing out there that generally people are like, oh my God, this is a disaster. I just want to go home and be with my family later.
And I would say that that's all true. And certainly I had no idea how the criminal justice system works. I think with people on the spectrum, you have to look at it again as a matter of degree. There are people who might not be as high functioning as me who wouldn't even understand the concept of you have the right to remain silent. And if they say, do you understand these rights? Person with autism can say yes and really right. not have a clue because they're trying to please the person who is asking the questions. Do you understand? Yes, I understand because I'm trying to please you. Mm-hmm. So everything can be from the standpoint of wanting to please the person. And that's true, not just with law enforcement, but across the board. Autistic people tend to really want to please the people who are in their lives, whether they're their parents, their spouses, or it happens to be law enforcement. Right. So it exacerbates the crisis. And no doubt that's true for neurotypicals who especially have never encountered the law, but it's doubly true, maybe triply true for people on the spectrum.
I love how you call us neurotypicals.
I never heard that phrase.
You've never heard that phrase? Yeah, that's pretty pretty ingrained in autistic culture these days.
That's funny. We get a label, Larry, for being, I guess, what would be called normal, I guess. a pejorative sounding label.
Neurotypical, right?
Neurotypical.
I've never heard that.
All right. But then, all right. So you end up under the umbrella of law enforcement, and I can only imagine the whole legal system has got to be just, it's probably just unfathomable. It's just uncomprehensible for someone as it is for most people, but that the whole weight of the legal system is coming down on them for doing whatever they have done.
Yeah. And again, I don't want to diminish how traumatic it is for anybody who right. goes through this. Because sometimes I think people think that I'm only speaking for autistic people and that this wouldn't apply to anyone else. Not at all. It's traumatic for anybody. But if you have an individual on the spectrum who is highly dependent on their parents, even into adulthood, right. as far as maintaining their lifestyle, some of these adults live with their parents at home. And so they're not independent. They're not married. They are basically dependent on their parents. And so you take an individual like that, you tell them, we may be separating you for as many as 5 to 10 years. You basically give them a regimen that's going to be very hard for them to follow because, again, people with autism do like to follow rules. But if the rules are constantly changing, especially when we get to the registry post-adjudication, it can create a very stressful situation. And again, it's stressful for everyone on the registry. I'm not going to discount that. But people on the spectrum, I've talked to many of them who are on the registry. The thing that gets them, keeps them up at night is, am I following all the rules? Because as we both know, there's so many of them, they change constantly and they bend over backwards. But certainly being in prison is torture for an individual on the spectrum. They're not going to get the street smarts that you need when you're in prison as far as what you need to survive in prison, politically affiliating with a gang or not saying what your conviction is. People with autism are just honest. What are you in for? Oh, I'm in for such and such. And even though they've been told, hey, you can't tell anybody that, it's that honesty. It's very hard for them to help it. And so you're setting them up for abuse. And if there's a better way, if there's a way to help an autistic individual so they don't reoffend, but don't put them in a situation that you're putting, it would be the equivalent of like putting a 10 or 11-year-old. And to me, it's cruel. And if there's a way to avoid it, you still need to give that person treatment. I'm not saying that they should, whatever precipitated it should be ignored. But there's got to be a better way than what we're doing now.
I can't even fathom that they're, the system is completely ill-designed to handle anything outside of a very narrow focus of what would be, you know, normal. And I don't even want to use the word normal in this case, because the people that go to prison have done something wrong. And somebody that has a high degree, you know, high IQ, is, you know, a master's degree or whatever, there's no services in prison just the same for that person as there's not services for someone that is on the spectrum and very low functioning. They're stuck kind of in the same class of not having any resources available to them, and they both end up being mistreated.
Absolutely. And I want to say something about master's degree, because there are individuals on the spectrum who have master's degrees.
Of course.
But there is oftentimes a gap between what they can do academically, because again, that's very structured, and what they can do in the real world. I mean, you have people who get master's degrees who have a hard time tying their shoes. I can't tie a tie myself. I mean, you have people who can't drive a car, literally, not because they don't want to drive a car, but because they couldn't drive a car, and yet somehow they're able to get a degree. So one of the defining features of autism, in my mind, is the split between certain abilities and other abilities. And I think that the best way to look at this in an extreme case is a savant. A savant could play a concerto by Tchaikovsky, but maybe not be able to have a coherent conversation with you. That's an extreme example that I'm giving. But in autism, you're always going to find that split. So, and this comes across in the adjudication process when the prosecutor is looking at the accomplishments of an individual on the spectrum. Maybe they graduated high school, maybe they worked a job, and they're going to focus on those accomplishments, not understanding that there are other deficits that are inherent with the disorder. In other words, just because certain people with autism can do some things doesn't mean that they can understand and appreciate other things. And I think there's this misconception that if somebody is accomplished, it must mean that they are not disabled in any way. And that nothing could be further from the truth. And the law is not equipped right now to even come close to understanding that, because as Larry says, it's basically a very black and white way of looking at it. Did you do it? Did you have it in your possession? Especially if it's a strict liability. So
And just to restate what you just said, so a person on the spectrum goes off and gets very, very high education, and then the judicial system looks at them as being, you should have known better.
Very oftentimes, that's what will happen. Prosecutors will look at the background of that person. They won't take into account that maybe the person never left home and is still living with their parents, even though they do have an advanced degree. There are always good reports that are written up by psychologists who can explain this, especially if there's information from childhood that can back it up. But prosecutors are going to look at what can the person do. And generally, that's what I like to be a strength-based person. What can the person do? But the prosecutor is using it against the person, not to help the person. So that's the major difference. They're looking for strengths, but they're looking for strengths so that they can throw that person in prison, ignoring what could be a death sentence to that person. It's very cruel. It's a cruel game that they play, in my opinion.
I do have a question. Wouldn't what you're talking about, wouldn't that require us to become nice as a people, which I don't believe we are nice, but prosecutors have the discretion to treat people taking into account these factors already. Jailers have the discretion to accommodate these things right now. If we were nice people and if we cared about the unit, and I'm talking about the person as when they're working their way through the system as a unit, if we give the damn about the unit, we would be able to do these things already. A cop doesn't need to know. I believe that training is all important, but a cop doesn't need to be taught that you can't be so damn aggressive with everybody. You ought to know that you don't like being treated that way, and you can assume that the average person doesn't either, right?
I have to agree with you. Yeah, there's an individual I'm communicating with through email, and he's in federal prison right now, and he has a chronic headache condition. And they're basically giving him Tylenol, and they're saying, well, there's nothing more that we can do for you. Right. Now, this is somebody with ASD who probably needs certain accommodations, like wearing sunglasses. But of course, sunglasses would probably be considered contraband. ADA, which is the American with Disabilities Act, is not followed at all in prison. They're allowed to basically get away with murder as far as not giving accommodations. And what would a good, decent human being do? As Larry just said, they would instinctively give these accommodations because it's the decent, moral, correct thing to do. And I just don't see it. I don't see it in all my interactions with these parents that I deal with on a regular basis who are trying to save their sons from the system.
So, well, I'm off my high horse now, but I just think that I think America, we pat ourselves on the back about what decent people we are. And if I really think if you look around, you'll find out that we're just not quite what you think. We have the highest level. We measure badly on so many measurements in terms of prenatal care for our newborns, for our education system is a disgraceful condition. We lock up so many people. We have the highest homeless percentage of population of the industrialized Western world. We incarcerate. I mean, Americans, are you really as nice as you think you are?
But Larry, if all those things are true, then why don't you just leave?
Well, that's what I should. And I'll tell you what I'll do. If Trump will leave, because he criticized all the things that he thought was wrong with America, if he'll leave, I'll leave.
Okay. I can see all the numbers going to zero now. We're just going to have to close up shop now.
He had the right to criticize. So am I less of American for criticizing America? That's what he did. And it's what he still does.
To pull it back, I think a direction that you were trying to go before, though, Larry, is that the person on the spectrum with the disability, once they enter into the court system, though, that their attorney should be able to address to some degree some of those deficiencies to help the person end up being properly represented. I think you were headed down that path.
That is where I was trying to head, but I don't think that when we elect our prosecutors, just think out on the campaign trail, if a prosecutor said, and I promise you this, if you elect me to be the district attorney, I'm going to make certain that I make accommodations for people who have deficiencies that have caused them to end up in the justice system, and we're going to take all those factors into consideration. Do you think that person would get a lot of votes from the compassionate Americans that are out there listening?
No. I'm pretty
okay,
sure
then
not.
The problem rests with us, doesn't it?
Oh, it totally does. I'm 100% on board with it's us. But even still, the person when your attorney goes up there and says, "I'm representing Mr. Autism," forgive me if that sounds offensive, but I would like to introduce that these are the issues that this person deals with that prevented them from understanding the actual impact of the crime that they were committing. Literally, like. The person doesn't understand that this is a crime. How can you be convicted of a crime that you can't even conceive is a crime?
Well, but then you'd have to go back to the liberal days where we were a little more lenient in terms of what we allowed with the mental disease or defect defense. After the attempted assassination of Reagan, states made and the federal system made it very difficult, which was already plenty difficult, to assert a diminished capacity, a mental disease or defect. All this stuff by the hardliners is considered excuse maker. All they're doing is making excuses, and you don't get a lot of sympathy for making excuses. You pled guilty, you did the crime. Why'd you do the crime? I mean, we're just not wired that way. I mean, that would require a complete revamping. We'd have to go back to the medical model that we had in the 1950s and 60s when we were a little bit more progressive in terms of how we dealt with corrections, particularly in the federal system. Compared to today when we have 200, well, we don't have 200,000 anymore. We have about 185,000, but we have far more prisoners than we had in the 60s and 70s in federal custody because we're much more hard-nosed in terms of lock them up, throw away the key. Hmm. The public doesn't give a damn about the things that we're talking about.
Well, let's move it forward. I can only imagine that the actual time served in prison is incredibly challenging. Just like your food schedule isn't even something reasonably regular. That's got to drive someone on the spectrum crazy that you might eat at 5 this day or 7 or 8 o'clock the next day.
Yes. And fortunately for me, I did not serve any time in prison. And there's not a day that goes by that I don't thank a higher power for that. But yeah, as far as individuals on the spectrum who are in prison, it's torture for them. It's absolute torture. They are ridiculed. Some of them are called retards. They are messed up physically because their cellmates just view them as quirky and strange and weird. And also the guards, they get into encounters with guards because sometimes they give rules that the person with autism doesn't understand. It's not logical. Why would I do it this way? I've always done it this way. Mm-hmm. And so the guard views that as mouthing off. And who is there to tell that autistic person, hey, it's probably not a good idea. You should just silently comply. Again, they want to comply, but they want to do it when they think something is logical. And everything about prison deviates from their natural schedule when they were on the outside. Everything. There's not one thing that's the same. So you have a recipe for a potential breakdown, a total breakdown of the person. And that's why it's so important to teach defense lawyers what's at stake here. And I feel bad for a lot of these individuals who are represented. I love public defenders. I love what they do, but sometimes they take on 100 or 150 cases, and it's really hard to get into the nuts and bolts and the nitty gritty of autism when you have 100 or 150 other cases. So it's very important that we train in light of not being the compassionate society that I wish we were. I think training is the next best thing. And sending a person to prison who has autism should be only a last resort. I mean, if they are just completely dangerous and are an imminent risk to harm someone, otherwise you're killing them. And nobody is the same when they go into prison than when they come out. But multiply that exponentially for someone on the spectrum.
Yeah, I totally don't want to diminish the impact of it, but all of the things that you've just described sound like it's the same for the oh my god, what is the word that, what do you call the neuronormals? Is that what you called them?
Neurotypicals.
Neurotypicals. It's torture for neurotypicals too. Well, let's move outside of prison into how it is on the registry. How does that complicate things?
Well, I just read an article recently, and these are statistics that I've seen over the years, that close to 80 to 85% of people on the spectrum are not employed. And again, I hate to keep emphasizing the weaknesses, quote unquote, of individuals on the spectrum, but these are realities that we have to face. And so the first thing that you're told when you get released from prison is you need to find a job. So we have a double handicap now for someone with a developmental disability and somebody who is on the registry, okay? It's going to be hard enough to find a job if autism was the only obstacle. It would be very difficult because only 15% of people do. And then you throw the registry label on, impose residency restrictions where you can only live 1,000 feet. And it's a recipe for failure because the bottom line is a lot of these jobs are very difficult for autistic people to do. And I'm talking about short order cooking where you have to cook 10 different people's meals at the same time. Those are typically the kinds of jobs that people get. Being a carpenter or doing maintenance of that sort of thing requires fine motor skills and gross motor skills and a set of multitasking skills that a person with autism may not have. They just may not have the skills that are needed for some of these jobs that are only offered, that registrants can only get, that no other population. You understand what I'm trying to say? So
I do. And so now you're going to mandate that the person has a job, or they're going to possibly, if they're on parole or whatever, you know, so then they might be under threat of going back to prison if they don't get a job. But then you're also saying that only 15% of the people under normal circumstances are able to find work. So now you force them into finding what many people aren't able to do to begin with. God, that is really a shitty way to treat people. Is there any compassion within the supervised release system for people on the spectrum?
No, there really isn't. They are given the same containment model. They are expected to follow the same containment model that everyone else is presented with. In an ideal world, what would I like to see? I'd like to see individualized therapy tailored to the person with autism, where you're not going to just bring in a government contractor who sees people as just ticking time bombs who are just going to reoffend at the next possible moment. You're going to have a person who knows something about autism, who knows that the person wants to comply. They need a direct set of instructions on how to be successful. And I like the Good Lives model. I think it would be good for everybody to use, but particularly for someone on the spectrum who can develop their interests to the best degree possible. But when you put somebody in a group setting, it's not a good situation for individuals with autism, because what ends up happening in those groups is people are pressured to talk about everything that they've ever done. And of course, someone with autism is going to be open about that from the outset. They're not going to have any problem saying what they've done, but then they feel all this pressure and it's a group setting, so they don't exactly know how to fit into that group. And so there are problems with those groups. A lot of people, a lot of parents have told me that their sons have just become hopeless being in those groups. And those groups are meant to be therapeutic. They're not meant to be torturous. And so the therapy really has to change, in my opinion, on the spectrum, because we're talking about a different kind of individual. And it's a cookie cutter system, what we have at the present time.
Larry, is there anything that you want to ask? I only have a couple more questions that I can think of.
Well, this just depresses me.
It does me too.
It does, because it exemplifies really what type of system we have. And unfortunately, the average American doesn't realize what type of system we have. And as I've been in this advocacy for a number of years than I care to mention, they rationalize that their situation is so unique that they got a raw deal because the system screwed them over because it was corrupt or whatever. And they believe the system's okay, but for their isolated incident. And this is rampant, ladies and gentlemen. Our system of criminal justice is, I mean, I don't think I can come up with the right word to describe, but
it's flawed. I mean, it's just simply, it's flawed. I mean, it has a lot of pieces. They're short of a complete overhaul. You would have to cut at it with 100 or 1,000 different ways to try and fix each little thing. However, you could look to some European models that seem to have a similar recidivism rate, a similar crime rate, but they don't have the same number of people incarcerated, and they don't have the same sort of problems post-prison or even during prison.
Well, they don't treat prisoners the way we do in most European countries. They mollycoddle them, is what we would call that.
Interesting.
What they do.
You mean they have prisons without walls or fences, right? They just like paint a line down.
Yeah, they. But we can't have that mollycoddling here. And like I say, it reflects on who we are. We get the government that we demand, and we're getting the system that we're happy with.
And Nick, one of the things that you mentioned was that many of these people on the spectrum aren't able to even leave home, even though they may have an advanced degree. So we'll call them high functioning, but they still live at home with mom and dad, or maybe in a group home. And then when they are released from prison and they have some kind of residency restriction, those places may be off limits of where they can go.
That's a very good point. And a lot of people, whether neurotypical or on the spectrum, have to have their residence pre-approved before they get out. So if the only place they can go is their parents' house, because that was going to be the place they would go anyway, and that happens to fall within that residency restriction, what has to happen? Well, the parent has to look for another place to live. I mean, clearly that's punishment. The parent has to move in order to accommodate the child. Sometimes the parent will look for an apartment, but again, apartments oftentimes do background checks. Yeah. So oftentimes it comes down to the parent having to move their place of residence to accommodate the child. And you can't tell me that that's not a form of punishment to the family and to the person on the spectrum.
I'm sure you could say it's not punishment, Larry. I mean,
I could
it's,
say that.
It's a civil regulatory scheme. Everyone's got to do what they got to do. If you didn't want to do the time, you shouldn't have done the crime. Blah, blah, blah. I can't even figure out where else to go. It's just, the whole thing is just garbage. It really is just garbage. And obviously anybody then with a disability, it just exacerbates the problem. It magnifies the problem so much greater.
Absolutely. And that's true with mental illness too, but my right. focus happens to be autism. So that's what I had. That's what I advocate for, but it would be true with a lot of different mental illnesses and other developmental disabilities, fetal alcohol syndrome, Down syndrome. Right. But we don't, you know, and one thing I want to say is autistic people are not inclined to commit crimes. They're not sexually deviant. If anything, they tend to be the victims of crimes more than the perpetrators. But when these misunderstandings happen or when they do commit a crime and it's a one-time thing, the system is in no position right now to understand why it happened or to show any compassion. And what Larry said, I mean, prosecutors couldn't run on that kind of ticket. I doubt even somebody like Larry Krasner could say that and get support from his progressive base, because there'd be other people in the base who would feel left out. Why can't I get that kind of compassion too? Right. So it's a very political thing, but I would like to see it improve for all people with mental illness and developmental disabilities, particularly though for me, autism, because that's where I have my skin in the game.
In closing up shop here, is there any way that you would like to offer for people to reach you either on Twitter, email? Do you have a website that you'd like to offer up to the people to check out?
Sure. My Twitter handle is NICOLASD 1977. And my website is autismandthelaw.com. And as of now, those are the two ways to reach me.
Awesome. I will also include those in the show notes. I have one last question.
Sure.
Do you think there's something about jazz that relates to you being autistic?
That's a good question. I actually think it had more to do with the fact that my dad brought me up on it. I had a steady diet of jazz growing up in the house. There was always Ray Charles records playing or Sinatra. And my dad took me to a Ray Charles concert when I was 5 years old. So I think he kind of indoctrinated me into the music. But I will say a love of music in general, a deep, deep love of music tends to be seen for people across the spectrum. So I don't think jazz per se, but I think music definitely.
The reason why I'm asking it that way is because the complexity of jazz and often not like pop jazz like Kenny G or something, but something that has much broader spectrum going on of chord progressions, the richer sounds or the richer instrumentation. I'm wondering if that doesn't tickle the innards, so to speak, of someone on the spectrum more so than a neurotypical.
It's definitely possible. I know of a couple of what you would call savants who are professional musicians. There's one by the name of Matt Savage, and he started playing professionally when he was 13, but he is on the spectrum and totally writes all his own music, is an absolute genius. There are a few other people whose names don't come to mind right now, but I've never really given that the kind of thought that I'd like to, but I think you might be onto something there, Andy.
I don't know. We can talk about it on Twitter. Thank you so much, Nick. I can't thank you enough for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure and privilege. I thank you for inviting me.
Have a great night.
Good to spend some time with you.
Likewise, Larry. Thank you.
Well, do you have anything else so we can shut this down?
Well, can't we go on for another hour?
We certainly can. I have to turn the tape over.
Well, it is right at 2 hours since we started.
It is
so 50. we can stop.
We can. All right. Well, we are done. Thank you very much, Larry. I appreciate it, and I hope that you have a splendid night.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I hope you have a good visit, and look forward to seeing you again on the next podcast.
Thank you very much. Talk to you next week.
Bye.
Bye.